our conference. And his name is Cal Beisner, and he comes to us from Covenant College. He is author and lecturer on the application of Christian worldview, theology, and ethics to economics, the environment, political philosophy, history, and reasons for faith. At Covenant College, he is an associate professor of interdisciplinary studies, author of 11 books and over 150 published articles and book reviews. In addition to teaching at Covenant College, Beisner also lectures annually on Christian economics for Summit Ministries and for the Chattanooga Resource Foundation's Leadership Development Program, and speaks frequently for other organizations. He is a 1997-98 Humane Studies Fellow of the Institute of Humane Studies, has been a Literary Fellow for the Marguerite Eyre Wilbur Foundation four times, and was Chavon Scholar in Christian Ethics and Economics at Baylor University in 1989. He is National Chairman of the Economics Committee on the Coalition on Revival and Principal Author of the Coalition's Christian Worldview of Economics. He has been a contributing editor to World Magazine, The Freeman, Christian Research Journal, and Crosswinds, the Reformation Digest, and has written also for the Christian Renewal, Christian Research Journal, Discipleship Journal, Christianity Today, Chronicles, The Freeman, Perspectives, Contra Mundum, University Bookman, and other periodicals. He's a graduate of the University of Southern California with a B.A. in Interdisciplinary Studies in Religion and Philosophy, and of International College with an M.A. in Society with a specialization of Economic Ethics. Presently, he's working on his Ph.D. in Scottish History through the University of St. Andrews, Scotland. We've been hearing lectures on Scottish history, okay? He has been a newspaper editor and publisher, magazine editor, radio commentator, an elder in the Presbyterian Church in America. He lives with his wife, Deborah, a portrait painter, and their children, David, Susan, Kilby, Rebecca, Peter, Arthur John, and Grace, in a picturesque old house in the St. Elmo district of Chattanooga, Tennessee. We're tired just seeing all these things you've been doing. We welcome you, Cal.
Thank you. Thank you, Pete. You didn't need to go into all that. Of course, y'all know what a picturesque old house is. Actually, our house is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. And people come up to our house for the first time and they see that plaque next to the door and they kind of, "Ooh, that's neat," you know. And I said, "Do you know what that means?" "Well, no, I don't really." I said, "Well, that means, will somebody please buy this dump and fix it before it collapses?" but it was affordable. and so we've been trying to fix it ever since. But I am really pleased to be here. I've been hearing about this conference for several years, and I've had a number of students at Covenant College who've been through this, and they have come to us well prepared, or they've returned to us better prepared than when they left at the end of a spring semester. And I just very much appreciate what is going on here. And it is a humbling honor for me to be a part of this with you today and tomorrow. I hope that I can make a good contribution. Byron asked me to speak to you essentially these four times on matters related to Christianity and the environment. And what I want to do, this is going to perhaps be a little bit of a whirlwind for you. This lecture, I'm going to be delivering essentially from script. And it's going to be loaded with information. It's going to come at you real fast. And so you got to be ready to start just scribbling down if you want to get some of these facts down. But then in the remaining three lectures, I'll be speaking in a much more casual way to you and sort of reweaving some of the things that you will hear in this lecture. You're going to be introduced to some basic concepts and some basic facts in this lecture. And then in the three lectures that are yet to come, we'll be sort of heading off in different tangential directions from this. I did want to mention that I've, and Byron also told me that you all are our major readers, that you all walk away from here loaded with lots and lots of books. Well, I love that. I think very highly of that idea. I do speak pretty well every year for Summit Ministries, and one of Summit's mottos is, leaders are readers. You will not become a leader, whether in the church or in the surrounding society, unless you are a reader. And I'm not talking about just reading the daily newspaper or something like that. You need to read things that go below the surface. That's what prepares you. So Byron said I should be sure to bring plenty of my books. I had forgotten that he said I ought to ship them here in advance. So they haven't been here, but they're here now. Let me real quickly just tell you what they are. I left one of them out. But Prosperity and Poverty, The Compassionate Use of Resources in a World of Scarcity, is a general introduction to economics from the perspective of Christian worldview and Christian ethics. And it also includes a discussion of the role of the state in the economy. That book is out of print, by the way. So from me, here, is the only way you can get that anymore. I'm not aware of any place that has it anymore at all, unless perhaps, you know, some used bookstores here and there. Also out of print is Prospects for Growth, A Biblical View of Population, Resources, and the Future. Much of the theoretical basis for the talks that I'm giving here appears and goes into much more detail in this book here. That one, in fact, is so thoroughly out of print that there are 8 copies here, and I've got 3 copies left at home, and that's all I know of available. So if you want that, you don't delay. Man, Economy, and the Environment in Biblical Perspective has just last week gone out of print from Canon Press. But I have a number of copies of this available here as well as some more at home. And then this is my most recent book on this subject, Where Garden Meets Wilderness, Evangelical Entry into the Environmental Debate. This is sort of a friendly critique of evangelical environmentalism. Many evangelicals have become quite active and outspoken in environmental issues, and much of what they're doing I think is very good. Some of it I think is flawed, and so I'm trying to just sort of improve the contributions there. Now, those are all fairly related to what I'm talking about. Here are 3, and there's actually one more back here that I forgot to bring up, that are not. Evangelical Heathenism, Examining Contemporary Revivalism. If any of you are interested in missions, and from hearing the buzz around here a little bit, I understand there are a number of you who are, you need to know that many of the missions organizations around the world right now, evangelical missions organizations, especially among those that are heavily youth-oriented, have been very much infiltrated by a movement that is known by a number of different names, the moral government theology movement or the openness of God movement, things like this, that is not just simply not reformed, and you've been hearing a lot about the reformed faith and covenantalism and so on here, but not even Christian. It is a fundamental denial of the realities of the Christian faith. And this book is a critique of that movement. Then some of you might have run into what are called oneness Pentecostals from time to time, people who deny the doctrine of the Trinity and say that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are really all just one person relating to us in different ways. That's an ancient heresy, and actually the Trinity is my favorite subject. I've written 3 books on it, 2 of them published, and the other one still on the hard drive of my computer waiting for me to have time to polish it up. But this book, Jesus Only Churches, is a critique of the anti-Trinitarian oneness Pentecostals. And then here is a book called Psalms of Promise. And this book takes you through a study of the theme of the covenant on which Pastor Schlissel has been speaking to you. This goes through 19 different psalms and shows how the covenant is woven into each one of those, and it arranges them historically from creation to consummation through the whole of salvation history. These are sort of devotional expository essays. And then finally, back there, there's one other book, Answers for Atheists, Agnostics, and Other Thoughtful Skeptics, Dialogues Concerning Christian Faith and Life. That gives you actually a model right in front of you, dialogue form of of how to answer a wide variety of different questions about the Christian faith. So I would love not to have to carry any boxes of books back home with me, and you can help me feed my 4 1/4 dozen children by buying some books. I'm shameless, aren't I? Well, this first lecture is called People and Environment, Searching for Truth in a Maze of Contradictions. There's a great deal of conflicting information out there, and I hope to give you obviously not the final word on all the different issues, but some basic sort of principles, ways of thinking that will help you to evaluate environmental issue information as you encounter it. Now, pollution is a bad thing, and people make pollution while making the food, clothing, shelter, transportation, and other things they need and enjoy. More people, therefore, mean more pollution. And in the last century, world population has multiplied more than 3 times, as you'll see on a transparency, while average economic production per person has multiplied at least 4 or 5 times. Consequently, since pollution is the byproduct of productive activity, pollution should have multiplied by at least 12 to 15 times. And with that increase must have come an increase in all the ill effects of pollution, effects summed up in the disease and up in disease and death. In short, so many people making so much more wealth and so much more pollution should have significantly increased rates of disease and death. In other words, people should be living shorter lives. So goes the thinking associated with much of the environmental movement. But there's just one problem. People aren't living shorter lives, they're living longer, more than twice as long, in fact, as they were a century ago. This shows estimated life expectancy in the world and the United States. Compare 1900 with 1994. Of course, you might not think that's a problem. Since most of us would rather postpone our deaths, it seems most of us wouldn't call that a problem. But it is a problem for the ideology of the intertwined environmentalist and anti-population growth movement. It's a problem for them because it contradicts the expectations that naturally flow from their worldview. Their understanding of people and the impact of people on the world naturally yields an expectation precisely the opposite of what the facts tell us. Contradictions are nasty things. If we like to cling to pet theories and ideologies regardless of the facts. But they can be very helpful things if we're willing to be corrected by the facts. They can point out to us where our thinking needs correction. And if we pay attention to the most significant facts about population, economics, and the environment, they can tell us that the conventional wisdom about these fields, at least the wisdom that dominates the mainstream news media and education below the graduate level, is mostly wrong. This morning I'd like to consider 3 questions together. First, how do the environmentalist and anti-population growth movements, and for convenience sake, I'll refer to these simply as the environmentalist movement, envision human impact on the world? Second, what does empirical investigation tell us about human impact on the world? And third, what explains the great discrepancy that we will encounter between the environmentalist vision and reality? So question number one, how do environmentalists envision human impact on the world? Have you ever noticed how negative are the terms in which environmentalists describe human population growth? We noted a moment ago that the number of people living on Earth has more than tripled in the last century. Environmentalists describe this growth in some startling terms. It is the population bomb, to quote the title of the most famous book on the subject by butterfly biologist Paul Ehrlich, published in 1968, applying the principles of population biology to human population. Now, what do bombs do? Well, they explode, of course, and so we are the population explosion, to quote the title of another of Ehrlich's books, this one co-authored with his wife Anne in 1990. In fact, the Ehrlichs really sum up the whole point with the full title of their book, The Population Explosion from Global Warming to Rainforest Destruction, Famine, and Air and Water Pollution. Why Overpopulation is Our Number One Environmental Problem. The Ehrlichs aren't alone in their gloomy assessment of human beings and their numerical growth. In 1970, Kingsley Davis wrote contemptuously of humanity, quote, "In subsequent history, the 20th century may be called either the century of world wars or the century of the population plague," an attitude that fueled his suggesting 7 years later that population be reduced by promoting the breakdown of the family, very high divorce rates, homosexuality, pornography, and free sexual unions with easy access to abortion. The West German Green Party's Karl Amery said in 1983, "We in the Green Movement aspire to a cultural model in which the killing of a forest will be considered more contemptible and more criminal than the sale of six-year-old children to Asian brothels." A Rockefeller Foundation official has insisted, "The world has cancer, and that cancer cell is man." A view that has prompted the foundation to give millions of dollars to support population control. The Economist, a highly regarded news weekly, editorialized, "The extinction of the human species may not only be inevitable, but a good thing. This is not to say that the rise of human civilization is insignificant, but there is no way of showing that it will be of much help to the world in the long run." No doubt The Economist would hear a hearty amen from David Brower of Friends of the Earth, who considers other people's children pollution and therefore an environmental concern. Said he, "Childbearing should be a punishable crime against society unless the parents hold a governmental license. All potential parents should be required to use contraceptive chemicals, the government issuing antidotes to citizens chosen for childbearing. And I'll give you three guesses, of which the first two don't count, to figure out who's going to be first on the list of parents not allowed to have the antidotes." Brower is joined in his call for coercive birth control by Kenneth Boulding, who coined the phrase "spaceship Earth" to call attention to the alleged fragility and isolation of our little planet. "The right to have children should be a marketable commodity," he writes, "bought and traded by individuals, but absolutely limited by the state." Not to be left behind in this attack on reproductive freedom, Paul Ehrlich joins the chorus by saying, "Several coercive proposals deserve serious consideration, mainly because we will ultimately have to resort to them unless current trends in birth rates are revised." He suggests deindustrialization, since the wealth made by industries makes providing for children easier, liberalized abortion, and tax breaks for sterilized couples. So for environmentalists, we are the population bomb, the population explosion, people pollution, the population plague, a cancer sucking out the life of planet Earth. Why do they see us so? Because they view people as naturally destructive. Consider one of the more forthright and specific statements by a feminist environmentalist, Ryan Eisler. "The population crisis lies at the heart of the seemingly insoluble complex of problems futurists call the world problematique. For behind soil erosion, desertification, air and water pollution, and all the other ecological, social, and political stresses of our time lies the pressure of more and more people on finite land and other resources, of increasing numbers of factories, cars, trucks, and other sources of pollution required to provide all these people with goods, and the worsening tensions that their needs and aspirations fuel. And it is in connection with this population explosion that we can most clearly see how and why, under an androcratic, that is, a male-dominated system, our worsening problems are, in fact, insoluble." So what do growing numbers of people do, according to the environmentalist vision? Two things, primarily. They consume Earth's resources and so threaten humanity with poverty, war, and death. And they pollute Earth's environment and so threaten not only humanity, but also the rest of the planet's life forms with disease and death. This way of seeing things has been given a technical formulaic method of statement, I equals PAT, an equation popularized by Paul Ehrlich in which I represents cumulative impact on the environment, and by the way, when they mention impact on the environment, they always mean negative. If it's an impact on the environment, it is always negative. P, population, A, affluence, and T, technology. According to this equation, environmental impact must increase with any increase in population, affluence, or technology, and of course, it must increase even more with combined increases in two or all three of the factors. Now let's test this vision by looking at some relevant empirical facts. Question number two. What does empirical investigation tell us about human impact on the world? Remember the two parts of the environmentalist vision. Population growth strips the earth of its resources, and it pollutes the earth. Or to put things more starkly, because people are fundamentally consumers and polluters, the world is running out of resources and befouled by disastrous pollution. So let us ask what empirical investigation tells us about these two things. First, are we running out of resources? This is a rather tricky question to answer if we don't approach it with some caution. Why? Because what seems the most obvious way to answer it is fraught with problems. The most obvious way to answer it would be to try to make inventories of all kinds of resources, tons of this and tons of that, numbers of this and numbers of that, and compare today's inventories with the inventories of 10, 20, 50, 100 years ago, or better yet, with annual use, and then make predictions about how long it'll take for us to run out of things. That seems like common sense, and people have been trying it for a long time, but it turns out that it isn't sensible for two reasons. The first reason is that making those inventories and projecting years till their depletion is extraordinarily difficult because of both the vastness of the earth and the changing understandings of what resources are recoverable. Now, we have a graph up here that tells us a little bit about the vastness of those resources. We can illustrate the point by reference to some of our most commonly used metals: aluminum, chromium, cobalt, copper, gold, iron, lead, manganese, mercury, and uranium. Very rough estimates of the total amounts of these metals in the top layer of the Earth's crust, which is about 4% of the total crust, indicate that there's enough of them to last us at 1986 levels of consumption a little over 800,000 years in the case of the most rapidly depleting metal, which is copper, and a little over 2 billion years in the case of the least rapidly depleting metal, which is gold. However impressive these data might be, though, they're at least a little misleading. They assume that the whole amount of each of these metals is recoverable. But in reality, a great deal of each one is not. In most locations, the metals are too diffuse to be recovered at an economically sensible cost, so the time till depletion is exaggerated. It would seem reasonable then to adjust these figures downward by answering two questions. What level of concentration of each metal is necessary for recovery to be economically feasible? And second, what percentage of the total of each metal in the crust is found at that level of concentration or higher? Thus, for example, if we found that only 1% of all the copper in the upper layer of the Earth's crust were at a concentration adequate for economically feasible recovery, we could adjust our estimate of the years to depletion down to about 8,000 years instead of 800,000. But again, this isn't sensible. Why not? Because of changing understandings of what resources are recoverable. Improving technology constantly reduces the concentration of metals necessary for cost-efficient recovery. To stay with copper as our example, as of the 1970s, the concentration of copper ore necessary for economically feasible recovery was only about one-tenth what it was near the end of the 19th century, meaning that recoverable deposits, all those between the 19th century feasibility level and the 1970s feasibility level, multiplied by hundreds, if not thousands, of times. Similar improvements in recovery techniques apply to other metals as well. What this means is that our attempt to compare recoverable amounts with annual needs will be stymied by constantly changing definitions of recoverable amounts. Well, the second reason making those inventories and projecting the years till their depletion is so difficult is that people are constantly switching from one resource to another in response to changing technologies and prices, thus changing annual consumption rates, sometimes downward. For example, in the mid-19th century, people consumed I don't want us to get ahead here, Pete, if we can help that, or Don, I'm sorry. In the mid-19th century, people consumed a great deal of whale oil as a fuel for oil lamps. Today, they consume, for all practical purposes, no whale oil at all. People made dire predictions in the 19th century about the short time it would take to kill off all the whales and so run out of whale oil. It was only a matter of decades before the lights would go out. But then somebody named Thomas Edison got to work and the predictions fell flat. We stopped hunting whales to get light and started damming rivers and drilling holes and building wind turbines and splitting atoms and putting up solar panels to get it instead. Each of these changes upset the apple cart of predictions about the depletion of some resource used to provide us with light. And combined with changes like that discussed a moment ago regarding the concentration of a given resource necessary for cost-effective recovery, the result has been to make laughingstocks of all kinds of predictions of resource depletion. For example, in 1866, the U.S. Revenue Commission, in an effort to alleviate fears that the United States would soon run out of oil, ventured that synthetics would be available should that happen. In the next 82 years, the United States produced 37 billion barrels of oil and had no need for synthetic fuels as substitutes. In 1949, the Secretary of the Interior warned that the end of the U.S. oil supply was in sight. But over the next 5 years, daily U.S. production climbed by over 1 million barrels. Now we can go to the next transparency there. This shows what happened. This is petroleum years, reserves, in 10-year cumulative production. In each pair of bars, the left bar is known reserves at the time, and the right bar is how much petroleum was consumed over the prior decade before the date beneath the pair of bars. The exception is the last pair has only 6 years before it. But you see what's happening. Reserves compared with 10-year cumulative production are skyrocketing. We have more supply now than we had before, interestingly enough. Today, proven world oil reserves are more than 10 times decadal consumption. Similar results occur if we look at other commonly consumed minerals, as seen by looking at changes in proven reserves of various resources from 1950 to 1990. For all but one in this sample, proven reserves grew over the 40-year period despite intervening consumption. The one is tin. What that means is we have more known to be out there now than we knew to be out there before. Strange concept, isn't it, when we're using them? In short, the inventory and comparison method of figuring out whether we're running out of resources doesn't work very well, though what results it does give appear to contradict the environmentalist prediction of fast diminishing resources. Is there another, more sensible method? Well, yes, there is. We can instead apply one of the basic principles of economics to our problem. That principle is the law of supply, namely that as the supply of a good rises relative to demand for it, its price falls, while as supply falls relative to demand, price rises. Consequently, rising prices are evidence of falling supplies relative to demand, while falling prices are evidence of rising supplies relative to demand. If we're running out of resources, therefore, then resource prices must be rising. But if resources are becoming more abundant, then resource prices must be falling. Or to put things the other way around, rising prices mean diminishing resources, falling prices mean increasing resources. To know whether we're running out of resources, therefore, if we are to apply the principles of economics, we don't need to take inventories and compare them with annual consumption rates. Instead, we need to know the history of resource prices. While knowing this history has its own problems, they are comparatively few and simple compared with the problems attendant on the inventory and consumption rate method just discussed. They have to do primarily with adjusting for price inflation, the decline in purchasing power of money, international currency conversion, and indexing prices against wages to determine true affordability, which, though difficult, can all be done with reasonable accuracy. And one other thing that we need to adjust for is the impact of cartelization. That's essentially what we're seeing right now with the rise in petroleum prices worldwide. Petroleum prices have doubled in about the last 8 months worldwide. Has nothing to do with how much petroleum is out there available in the ground. It has everything to do with the agreement of the petroleum producing countries to artificially hold down production in order to drive the price up. What do we learn then about supplies of resources from price trends? Over the long term, every resource we extract from the earth, mineral, vegetable, and animal, is becoming more affordable, not less. In other words, more abundant, not less. In other words, less scarce, not more. With one exception about which we'll talk in a moment. To illustrate, look at the long-term trend in the affordability of minerals and energy revealed by indexing mineral and energy prices relative to wages. From 1900 to 1990, their prices relative to wages fell by nearly 90%, meaning that they are nearly 9 times more affordable now than they were a century earlier, despite a tripling of population and multiplying average consumption per capita by at least 4 or 5 times. On a shorter time scale, notice the general decline in inflation-adjusted mineral and more broadly defined raw materials prices in the decade from 1980 to 1990. I think we need the next one at this point. 1980 to 1990, I had turned that into three. So actually there are three different ones there, but they all illustrate the same thing with different lists. Go on to yet one more here. Okay, now look at the top group there. Real changes in mineral prices, 1980 to 1990. Out of all those minerals, only one went up instead of down. You can ignore my question in the margin there, what about uranium? This comes out of a book and I was reading and later on the author addressed that. But two went up. All the others went down. Also, look at the next transparency here. This one focuses on a specific metal. A dramatic, though fairly representative example of very long-term price and affordability trends is shown for copper in figures spanning nearly 2 centuries, from 1801 to 1990. As you can see, the inflation-adjusted price of copper fell to about one-third its starting level. That's the upper line. Look at the higher line, the darker one. That's the inflation-adjusted price. More important, the price divided by wages fell to about 1/40 its starting level. In other words, and that's the lower line there, see how it goes way down to practically nothing at the end there. In other words, copper was about 40 times more affordable in 1990 than it was in 1801. By the way, this figure illustrates another significant point. It's important to think of trends as long as possible, because shorter trends can be deceiving. As you can see here, despite some significant short-term increases in price that happened from time to time, the long-term downward trend is still clear. I mentioned that there's one extractive resource for which the long-term price trend has not followed the general downward pattern of other resources. That resource is wood. Although the inflation-adjusted price of wood has remained fairly stable for centuries, despite growing population and growing use of wood, still, it has not fallen, as have other resource prices. Why is that? Well, the best explanation I have found is that people have only recently begun to do with wood what we've been doing with most food for thousands of years, farming it. Until recently, natural supplies of wood have been so vast relative to people's needs for it that they presented no significant constraint on consumption. Plenty of wood was available from nature at affordable prices. In fact, simple inventories indicate that there is as much wood growing in the world today as there was at the turn of this century, if not perhaps even more. But as population has grown and consequently demand for wood has grown, natural supplies have been strained, and as a result, prices have risen in recent years. However, in the last half century and increasingly in the most recent decades, wood farming, plantation forestry, has become increasingly common, and for that reason, I predict that in a few more decades, the price of wood will begin to decline as plantation forestry supplies higher and higher percentages of total wood consumed. Before long, wood harvested from nature will constitute no greater proportion of total wood harvested than food harvested from nature constitutes of total food harvested. As we approach that time, wood prices will decline, and its affordability will rise, just as food's prices and affordability have been doing for a long time. And that's illustrated by some long-term price trends for wheat, which you'll see on the next one here. Wheat price is indexed by the Consumer Price Index, in other words, just indexed by inflation. In the upper graph there, notice the long-term trend is significantly downward from 1801 to 1981. But indexed by wages, the wheat price divided by average wages, notice what happened there. It's an enormous decline. What we pay for wheat now is practically nothing compared with what people paid for wheat in 1801. Well, it's assessment time on one question anyway. How has the environmentalist prediction of resource depletion fared? Not well. It gains no support from long-term inventories. Indeed, those generally oppose it. But more importantly, it's positively falsified by long-term price and affordability trends. Far from running out of resources, we are experiencing a general increase in their supply. Now, before we leave the subject of resources, however, let me mention one other curious exception to the trends. And this is an exception that I believe will continue indefinitely into the future. There is one resource whose long-term price trend not only has been, but I believe always will be, upward. One resource that is getting more scarce, not less, over time. Can any of you think what it is? Pardon? Uranium? No. You got that off the marginal note, didn't you? Somebody over here said water? No. Land? No. Pardon? Silicon? Oh, no, definitely not. The answer happens to be people. The long-term price trend of human labor has been upward and will continue to be so. This means that people, interestingly enough, are getting more scarce, not less. People are getting more scarce, not less. How can this be so with the tremendous increases in population that we noted at the very start of this lecture? It is because the supply of something, it's because scarcity is not an absolute, but a relative measure. It's a measure of the supply of something relative to the demand for it. And what the long-term price trend of labor tells us is that the demand for labor, for what people do, has been rising even faster than its supply. We'll return to this later and see why it's so. That'll be a crucial point in our whole discussion. So then, we're not running out of resources. But what about the second major prediction of the environmentalists, that all our economic activity designed to produce the food, clothing, shelter, and other things we consume is polluting the world to death? Is that true? The answer is an unequivocal no, qualified by a nuanced and temporary yes, and a final no. Let me explain. Over the long term, in advanced economies, pollution is falling, not rising. Consider first air pollution in the United States. This is an index of national ambient air pollution concentrations in the United States, 1976 to 1990. Actually, that should be to 94. Titled wrong. Goes to 94. You can see the air pollutant concentrations fell significantly over this period of time. And by the way, none of these air pollutant concentrations has violated the quality standard set for it by the EPA since 1988, as you can see from the next transparency. The horizontal line is the EPA's standard for the various ones, and the last time we had a violation was ozone in 1988, as far as national ambient concentrations are concerned. All of our air pollutant national ambient concentrations have been below the health risk level since then. This picture is similar for water pollution, as illustrated by graphs of phosphorus loadings and DDT levels in the Great Lakes. You can see here, again, the trends are downward, clearly downward. Also, as recycling rates rise, solid waste emissions are declining. These sorts of statistics are fairly typical of those for other economically advanced countries, principally those of Western Europe, the United States and Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan, as demonstrated by several chapters in the book, The State of Humanity, an outstanding book edited by Julian and Simon. In short, pollution rates are falling in advanced economies. The picture is different, though, in developing economies. This is because those economies are simply going through the same process the advanced economies went through before them, and on the whole, they're going through it faster. Some of you have heard of what demographers call the demographic transition. It denotes the tendency of human populations to go from stability from stable or slow growth to rapid growth during early stages of industrialization, and then to return to slow growth or stability at later stages of economic development, because with increasing wealth, death rates fall before birth rates. The line that you see there that goes up in a needle-like peak is a line measuring growth rate, not population, but population growth rate. As you enter a transition from a subsistence agricultural economy to an industrial economy, you suddenly have a rapid increase in population growth rate, and then as you finish that transition, population growth rate declines. The reason for this is that early on, death rates fall. That is, people live longer because they're wealthier. And it takes time before birth rates begin to fall to match those. When you know that on the average, 4 out of 10 children born are going to die before they reach the age of 2, and that 5 out of 10 will die before they reach the age of 5, you tend to have more children. If you want to raise 4 children to adulthood, maybe you'll have 8. Birth rates slow more slowly than do death rates as economies grow. The result is, for each such population, a growth rate curve that is fairly flat at both ends but has a spike in the middle. Now, a similar phenomenon occurs related to pollution. I call it the pollution transition. As economies make a transition from subsistence agriculture to industrialization, pollution levels rise. At the same time, however, the benefits of the polluting activities in increased supplies of food, clothing, shelter, and all other goods outweigh the costs as measured in human health and life expectancy, a fact proved by the fact that life expectancy rises throughout the transition. However, when economies make another transition from industry-dominated to service and technology-dominated, and from low-efficiency to high-efficiency industry, pollution emissions fall at the same time that productivity and consequently the standard of living continue to rise. Of course, not all economies go through this transition simultaneously. Some start early, others start later. Economies that begin their economic development early form a first wave in the transition. Those that begin it later form later waves. However, because the later waves get to take advantage of pollution abatement technologies developed by the earlier waves, they go through the transition more quickly, other things being equal, and never reach as high levels of pollution as did the first wave. The picture here, of course, is idealized, and in reality, there are not just three waves. There are as many waves as there are economies, some starting earlier, others starting later, and with different curves and peaks. But the general principle is illustrated well here. There's every reason to believe, therefore, that pollution levels will begin to decline fairly soon in today's developing countries, and that in them, as in the advanced countries, the benefits of the early economic growth that causes the upswing in pollution will outweigh the risks, while the period of the downswing in pollution will all be positive, combining a growing economy with declining pollution. What can we conclude, then, from historical statistics and the application of some economic insights? That the environmentalist's view of people is badly mistaken. In short, Ehrlich's famous formula, I equals PAT, cumulative impact on the environment equals population times affluence times technology, is false. Indeed, it is almost precisely the opposite of reality, and I'll return to that in a later lecture. If we sought only to know these facts, we could stop here. But we have one more question to ask. What explains the discrepancy between environmentalists' expectations and reality? How can environmentalists have gotten things so nearly backward? How can they have thought that human impact on the environment was so disastrous and that this impact must increase with growing population, affluence, and technology? Several factors, I believe, contribute to their confusion. In this lecture, we'll see a few. We won't, I think, have time to see all of them. Those will carry over into the next one. Insights from economics regarding human incentives and the meaning of scarcity. Third, some of them, having observed the simultaneity of high population growth and great poverty in third world countries like India and China in the 1950s and 1960s, and sub-Saharan Africa in the 1970s and 1980s, have mistakenly thought that the population growth caused the poverty, when in reality it was both an effect of very early economic growth. Population growth was an effect of very early economic growth, which caused declining death rates through better nutrition, sanitation, and healthcare, and also that population growth was a cause of additional economic growth spurred by increased consumer demand. Had these same people observed Europe and North America in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, they might have predicted for them the same great disasters, famine and plague, they have predicted over and over again for today's developing world. They would have been wrong 2 centuries ago, just as they have been wrong again and again in the last several decades. Each of these mistakes is worth considerable discussion in itself. But this morning I want to focus on a fourth, because I think it is most fundamental. It is that environmentalists like Ehrlich don't understand the nature of human beings. They confuse them with animals. But years ago, when I was growing up, one of the principal distinctions we were taught between people and animals was that animals must adapt to their environment, but people can adapt their environment to themselves. That rather simple distinction, true as it is but one element in a rich story of how people relate to their environment. Recall for a moment the low view of people evident in much environmentalist language. People are the population bomb. And what do bombs do? They explode. So we're the population explosion, or we're people pollution, or a cancer, or a plague on the earth. All of these images are destructive. And as we've seen, they are quite inconsistent with the empirical picture we get from looking at people's actual long-term impact on the environment. But there's a very different way of understanding people. A way offered by biblical Christianity. A way that is much more consistent with the long-term empirical picture. We first encounter it in the first chapter of Genesis, where we read, God said, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Then God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." These verses are probably familiar to many of you. But what would a novice reader think was meant by the image of God here, if he were to attend carefully to the immediate context? Imagine yourself in his place. You've just read this startling statement, "And God said, let us make man in our image." What would you already know about God that would help you to understand the meaning of the phrase, "in our image"? Well, you'd know what you had read in Genesis 1, 1 through 25. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So the image of God includes creativity. Then God said, "Let there be," and behold, look at the list. Light, a firmament, and oceans, and sea creatures, and dry land, and grass, and herbs, and trees, and stars, and sun, and moon, and birds, and land creatures, an astonishing variety of things living and non-living. And he instructed all the living things to multiply and fill their various niches in the world. So the image of God includes a wonderful love of variety, and life, and fruitfulness. So, if you were just starting out reading the Bible, what would you think God's image was? Principally, creativity. And that is the first great distinction between the environmentalist and biblical views of man and his relationship to the world. Environmentalism, in non-Christian circles at least, but all too often even among Christians, starts off on the wrong foot, denigrating mankind, denying the imago Dei. It sees man chiefly as consumer, not producer, and because it does, it concludes that he is exhausting the resources of the earth. Scripture has a different vision. It does not say, then God cursed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, but rather God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. The human race is not the population explosion, but the population blossom. Not the population boom, but the population bloom. Not people pollution, but the people solution. Not cancer, but an answer. Eat your heart out, Jesse Jackson. This different vision. Of course, George Grant is much better at that sort of thing than I am, but this different vision begets a different prediction. That people, because God made them in His image to be creative and productive, because He gave them creative minds like His, can bring order out of chaos and higher order out of lower order, actually making more resources than we consume. So the biblical view of man and the universe predicts that as we apply our minds to raw materials, scarcity of resources will decline. In other words, the supply of resources will increase relative to the demand for them, causing falling labor capital costs of resource production and falling inflation-adjusted resource prices. And that, as we have just seen, is precisely what we find when we look at history. But I risk running ahead of myself. Let's back up a little and consider more carefully what we have in mind by the imago Dei in mankind. And related to that, God's design for mankind in the earth. Scripture indicates three principal elements in the image of God in man. In Ephesians 4:24, Paul tells believers to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. There is then a moral element to the image of God. In Colossians 3:10, Paul writes of this new self as being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. So rationality is another element of the image of God in man. And the context of Genesis 1:26 implies that creativity is a third element. These three characteristics, holiness, knowledge, and creativity, ought all to be employed by man in fulfilling the vocation God gave us, to rule over the earth. For while the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, for He founded it and established it, Psalm 24, 1 and 2, God has entrusted the rule of the earth to mankind. For the highest heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth He has given to man, Psalm 115, verse 16. Man and woman, therefore, God's image bearers, were initially called to labor wisely, righteously, and creatively in loving fellowship to subdue and rule the earth and every living creature on it, whether in the sky, in the waters, or on the land, to cultivate and guard the garden God initially planted, and to spread that garden over all the globe. But Scripture tells us that rather than acting as a responsible, accountable steward, mankind rebelled against God's rule, hoping thereby to become supreme himself, like God, knowing good and evil. Every aspect of the image of God in man was corrupted by the fall. What had been a sound mind became unsound and darkened by falsehood, Romans 1:21. What had been a clear conscience untainted by sin became fouled with guilt and fear, Titus 1:15. He who had been alive in righteousness and holiness became dead in trespasses and sins, Ephesians 2:1. His once fertile and creative brilliance collapsed into fruitless deeds of darkness, Ephesians 5:11. The consequences were disastrous for people, other living creatures, and the earth itself. The corruption of our knowledge, holiness, and creativity affected not only our own inward nature, but also our dominion, cultivation, and guarding of the garden, and ultimately our stewardship of the whole earth. We were cast out of the garden and barred from returning to it in our fallen condition. Since we refused to submit to God, we were no longer worthy of the earth's unreserved submission to us. Hence God said, because you have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat from it, cursed is the ground because of you. So in toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust. and to dust you shall return. Because of the fall, with the breaking of fellowship with God, human fellowship was broken. Genesis 3:24 and 3:7. With strife beginning between husband and wife, 3:16. And continuing between brother and brother, 4:1-8, the killing of Abel by Cain. Human fertility, Genesis 3:16, and creativity and dominion, Genesis 3:17-19, all were frustrated. By his curse on the ground, Genesis 3:17, God subjected the creation to futility, Romans 8:20 tells us, so that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Indeed, man's wickedness increased through the generations following Adam and Eve until at last every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. And the Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals, creatures that move along the ground, and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them. But there was a man, one man, who was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. Through Noah, God saved the human race and all the rest of life on earth. I am going to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens, God told Noah. Every creature that has the breath of life in it, everything on earth will perish. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you will enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. You are to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you. In the ark, the world, human and subhuman alike, was saved. What happened through Noah was but a foretaste, a mere glimmer of what God would later achieve through his Son. In his life, he exercised a wise, righteous, and life-giving dominion over the earth itself, calming a storm, over plant and animal life, multiplying loaves and fishes, and even over human life, healing the sick and raising the dead. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us, and by his death saved us from God's wrath, reconciled us to God, gave us the gift of righteousness, and restored us to life, so that now those who are his are being restored in knowledge and in righteousness and holiness. Having died for us, he rose again from the dead so that for all who have died with him, just as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, we too may have a new life. Set free from slavery to sin and made again the servants of righteousness and of God himself, Romans 6. Having risen from the dead, Christ now sits at God's right hand, from whence he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet, including death, the last enemy. Then the end will come when he hands over the kingdom to God the Father after he has destroyed all dominion, authority, and power. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. The effects of the atoning death, victorious resurrection, and triumphant ascension of Christ, then, sweep over all creation, including human beings, animals, plants, and even the ground itself. They include the restoration of the image of God in the redeemed, and through them and by common grace even through many who are not redeemed, the restoration of knowledge, holiness, and creativity in working out the cultural mandate, including human multiplication, subduing and ruling the earth, transforming the wilderness by cultivation into a garden, and guarding that garden against harm. As the evangelical authors of the book Earthkeeping in the 90s put it, redeemed men and women are to be fellow heirs with Christ, Christ the sustaining logos of the world, in whom all things consist. The idea that humanity, redeemed humanity, is to share in that creatorly task is clearly the implication of Romans 8:19. Because of what Christ has accomplished, the creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. Such then is a biblical vision of man, made in the image of God, fallen into sin and death, and now in and by the last Adam, being restored to righteousness and life. This creature, a little lower than God, crowned with glory and honor, according to Psalm 8, is what we have in mind when we talk about population growth and its effects on resources and the environment. While environmentalists fear that human population growth will strip the earth of its resources and strangle it with pollution, biblical Christians, particularly those who are aware of the continuing growth of Christian faith around the world, with the positive transformation of culture that it can bring, can have confidence that by the grace of God, through the death, resurrection, and ascension of Christ, and His present reign over all things, continued population growth will result not in the depletion, but in the increased abundance of resources, and not in increased pollution of the earth, but in its increased cleansing and transformation from wilderness to garden, from its bondage to decay into the glorious freedom of the children of God. Instead of viewing people as fundamentally consumers and polluters, as environmentalists do, Christians view them as fundamentally producers and restorers. Thus, Christians have a firm worldview basis on which to predict and explain the empirical trends that we saw in the first part of this lecture. What shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase? The Apostle Paul asked rhetorically in Romans 6:1. Shall we, presuming on the grace of God demonstrated in the glorious redemption we've just described, turn our backs on the call of creation stewardship and exchange a wise and righteous and creative dominion over the earth for a foolish and depraved and destructive tyranny over it? By no means, Paul answered. We died to sin. How can we live in it any longer? Far from justifying a careless attitude toward creation, the vision I have sketched calls precisely for the pursuit of ever-improving care of creation. Care, however, that differs significantly from the subservience to nature that characterizes much of the environmental movement. We are not the earth's servants, but God's. And He has called us to serve Him insofar as our relationship with the earth is concerned by wise and righteous and creative dominion. This entails our fulfilling His command to multiply and fill up the earth, to subdue and rule it, and to cultivate and guard it. History tells us that mankind can do these things successfully. Indeed, that as human population has grown, we have done them increasingly successfully. What I predict with great confidence, based on both this biblical vision and a careful study of the historical impact of human culture on the environment, is that people all over the world can expect a cleaner, safer, more healthful, more beautiful environment for the future. Not automatically. No, it will take lots of intelligent, hard work and lots of good moral choices. But those are what God made people to do, and they are what Christ's redeeming work is enabling us to do despite our fall into sin. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that we should pave over the world, the whole planet, which is hardly likely anyway, granted that human settlements presently occupy only about 2% of the Earth's land mass, excluding Antarctica. We are to transform the Earth into a garden, not an inner city slum or a parking lot. But notice, we are to transform it into a garden city. In the Bible, you start in the garden, in Genesis, and in Revelation, you end in the garden city. Neither am I predicting utopia. I do predict great material wealth and a healthful, beautiful environment for the vast majority of mankind everywhere. But we must not confuse quantity with quality. The world of the future will almost certainly be wealthier and environmentally cleaner than it is today. But it may also be vastly evil. Which it becomes depends on whether its people follow Jesus Christ, the Son of Righteousness. Thank you.